We are going to start off with, just to kind of give you an idea of what our schedule looks like this morning, we're going to start off with a public hearing on 2117. We'll then go to a public hearing on 2122. And then we'll see where we are at with those, and then we'll move into a work session most likely on 2119 and 2121 first, and then 2119 second. So, gives you a little rundown. So I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2117. And Matt, why don't you give us a rundown on that, please?
House Bill 2117 changes the requirements for the Oregon Investment Council member who fills the position representing the Public Employees Retirement Board. It requires the person to be a member of the Public Employees Retirement System and to have been elected to the OA, to the Oregon Investment Council by the Public Employees Retirement Board members. And it also changes the compensation for that member of the board.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to take the folks that are on the list are just slightly out of order because I'd like to have State Treasurer Randall Edwards come up first. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and begin whenever you're ready.
Great. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. The bill before you, as your staff outlined, talks about the composition or the selection of the members on the Oregon Investment Council. And what I thought I'd do is kind of give you a little overview of what the council's role is and what the PERS board role is and how they work together on managing and investing pension monies for the state pensioners throughout Oregon. The PERS board is the administrative board on behalf of PERS. They're the ones who set up the policies following your statutes, that the laws that are created around benefits, and are the administrators of the accounts. It's an 11-member board. All are appointed by the governor. Three are public members, and in statute, they basically are from the private sector. They're not members tied to PERS in any way. Eight are also public, from the public sector, four are from management, and four are from representative collective bargaining units. So that's how the composition of the 11 are made up currently in statute. The Oregon Investment Council is a 5-member board. There are one of the three are from the public members from the PERS board. So of the three that are sitting in the public membership role on the PERS board, are selected. One of the three are selected by the governor to serve on the Oregon Investment Council. Three are also chosen, if you see in the bill, by statute, again appointed by the governor with specific backgrounds. I sit on the council as treasurer by statute again, and then there's an ex officio member who's Jim Boyko, the PERS director, and a non-voting member. So our 5-member board is made up of that. The Oregon Investment Council is charged to be the fiduciary of the funds on behalf of the beneficiaries. That fund today for the PERS beneficiaries is about $40 billion, and it has been growing rapidly over the last few years with the bull market. There are a lot of checks and balances in how we as a council operate. I just had my first meeting recently, so I'm learning specifically how the council works, but there are lots of checks and balances. Again, 5-member board takes a majority to approve hiring and firing managers, making policy about how we invest in the long term, how we reallocate assets as we go along, looking at portfolios. We hire outside consultants, managers to help us manage these monies. I have a professional staff in the Treasury who is staffed to the council who not only help me but help each of the council members. We are tied to fiduciary laws that are federally driven about how we manage and invest these monies. These are trust monies. We invest them on behalf of the beneficiaries. They are not a state asset. They are the beneficiaries' assets. And federal law really puts us in a box about how we look at managing these and investing these monies. And there's a rule called the prudent person rule, which really drives how we make these investments. It's basically blind to any sort of social investing, if you will. It's really to make money for the actuarial assumptions assumed on this program. Long story short is it's a very professional organization in the Oregon Investment Council and how we manage our monies. And I think that's been borne out in the returns that you've seen over time by the fund. The bill was submitted by my predecessor, and I really can't speak to specifically where he was going with some of those changes in the bill. But the bill, as it's written today, would change who would serve from the PERS board by requiring the person to be a member of the PERS system and not of one of the three private sector members. So that would have been a change as drafted. The bill would also have eliminated the governor's ability to appoint the person to the Oregon Investment Council and have the PERS board appoint that member. So you give the appointing authority to the PERS board. Personally, I really want to see the governor have that authority to appoint the PERS member to the Oregon Investment Council. I understand there will be an amendment by the group following me that will make a change to the bill that will basically restore the governor's authority to appoint the Oregon Investment Council member from the PERS board, but slightly broaden from the current statute, which only limits it to the three public members, to include the entire 11-member board. So there's a little more discretion on who he might or he or she might pick in the future. I support this amendment. The current public member, Mark Gardner, is done an outstanding job, and this amendment, as I would understand it, is going to be proposed, wouldn't affect his position right now on serving on the board. So I want to say that I really don't want to see us change his position because, quite frankly, he's doing a good job. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that was sort of the thrust of the bill.
Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Why is it that you would like to have that position appointed by the governor instead of being selected by the PERS board?
Well, I think that's been the history of the appointment since the Oregon Investment Council was created, and I think having the governor appoint has been a very strong way in which, again, to make a selection, to have him, because he appoints the board in the first place, he's appointing all of them. I think it's good for him to have the ability to appoint or her to appoint the council. It's worked in the past, and I don't think there's a need to change it to give him that authority.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randall, I guess I'm trying to struggle to find out to understand what the problem is that we're trying to solve. Number one, and number two, as I read this, the way this is constructed, we could have a Senate confirming a member appointed by the PERS board, and I'm just trying to figure which is sort of we're taking an executive appointment out of the executive, putting it into a board, but it's still subject to Senate confirmation. And so if the Senate doesn't confirm a member that the PERS board selects, then what? And so it's just kind of a strange construction in how this is made, but I guess I'm still just trying to figure out what problem we're trying to solve.
As I said before, my predecessor drafted this bill. I'm not quite sure, never did get a chance to find out specifically what it was that he was going after here, on particularly in Section 1. The check, you're right, the check is currently, and it goes back to Representative May's point about the governor in appointing these members has to be confirmed by the Senate. So currently, if they're rejected, obviously, the governor has to come back and with another appointee. I guess as the bill is constructed, that'd be the same thing. If the board appointed and Senate didn't like that appointment, they could have to come back and select, instead of one of the 11, it'd be now a pool of 10. So I'm not sure what that would achieve, other than it would just bring it back to the board again.
Representative March?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Treasurer, this provides that the other member is compensated in a different manner than the rest of the board. Could you kind of explain the differences in that?
That's a good question. I don't know if I can explain why the compensation was intended to change under this bill. Mr. Chair, as I understand it, maybe somebody, I'm not as familiar about the PERS board itself, how they're compensated, if they are. I can say the Oregon Investment Council is not compensated other than for per diem, I mean, in the sense of covering costs of travel, et cetera. But it's a de minimis amount of money. It's a voluntary board, in other words. My assumption is PERS boards are similar thing.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck.
If we decide to do something with this bill, before we do it, I'd like to see visually, it helps me on paper to see see the members of these boards, you know, how they're, I mean, you articulated it verbally, but it just helped for me to, you guys could prepare a little piece of paper, the investment council, PERS board, where the people come from. I think that would be helpful for all the...
I got to say, I was struggling with this, Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, before, to see how the two lined up.
Right.
I'd be happy to help that, too.
To see that.
Great.
Any other questions? One question that I have, Mr. Treasurer, is if the bill is changed to allow the governor to pick from any board, from any board member, I should say, then how is that going to be different than what is currently done?
And again, this kind of goes to Representative Beck's question, how these two are married, but right now on the PERS board, there are three public members of, there's 11 members, three are public. Again, the whole board appointed by the governor. And those members are basically not tied to PERS in any way. They're usually from the private sector. And right now, of those three, one of the three is appointed by the governor to sit on the Oregon Investment Council, and currently that's Mark Gardner. What this bill would do is say, now the governor, instead of picking from the three, could actually pick from the 11 to decide who might serve on the investment council. And that the governor, again, appoints all 11 members of the board. So since he appoints them, he could then have a little more discretion on if he wanted to go beyond just those three to put them on. That's, in essence, what the bill does. It just broadens slightly where he can or she can go with appointments to that board, to the council.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Burr.
Mr. Chair, I just want to understand, you're here primarily because the former treasurer put this bill into the path, but you don't advocate really any part of it.
I'll support the amendment that's going to be offered. I don't think it hurts to have the governor have the discretion to broaden his purview, currently the governor, his purview on who he might select. You know, the other eight members typically are employers and employees, and they have some interest in the PERS fund, obviously. So I think opening that up slightly would be fine. I mean, I don't know if anybody from the governor's office is going to testify on this bill, but I don't see a problem with that. Because again, as I said in my testimony, the box by in which we operate in the Oregon Investment Council is very tight as fiduciaries. So I think giving the governor a little more discretion doesn't somehow change what our decision making will happen in the Oregon Investment Council.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, then I'd like to, I'll go back to the top of the list, Beth Ann Darley, Rich Peppers, and Tricia Smith. Oh, and Mary, you're going to come up with this group too?
Oh, we're not.
Is this really safe?
Is it safe for us? Or for you?
No, I was concerned about my committee here.
Oh,
I think this is over to the chair.
That's right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public employee union of nearly 20,000 classified school employees located throughout the state in our K-12 community college, ESDs, et cetera, et cetera. I'm happy to be here to discuss House Bill 2117 with you. The committee is passing out a Hannah Gross version of the bill with our suggested changes. OSEA, and I think the rest of us here, although they'll speak for themselves, believes in two things. It is important that our members be represented effectively on the OIC when their PERS retirement funds are being invested, so that they are invested as appropriately, as successfully as possible. However, we believe it is most important that all members of the OIC be qualified to serve on that very important council. The OIC does more than invest PERS funds, and it is responsible for investment of all funds of the state. And we think that there are very few public non-elected positions in the state that are more important than those on the OIC. So we are suggesting, while we appreciate the former treasurer's intent in this bill very much, we believe that it is too restrictive. The current law, in our opinion, is too restrictive by restricting the governor to only select from three public members of the board as a member of the OIC. We think that the original bill, as written, was also too restrictive in restricting the governor's choice to only the PERS members of the PERS board, if that makes sense to you. We believe a much better solution is to allow the governor to choose between all members of the PERS board in an effort to get the most qualified, best representative on the OIC from the PERS board. The Hannah Gross version of the bill, which we passed out to you, we believe accomplishes that. It takes the language out that allows the PERS board to select the member. It also takes the language out which requires that that member be a member of the PERS system. So it allows the governor to choose any PERS board member as the member representing PERS on the OIC. And with that, I'll let my colleagues speak.
Mayor Botkin with AFSCME. I would pretty much agree with what Tricia had to say. We've been sitting in the back trying to figure out what the compensation statute said. I noticed that Representative Marsh was looking for the ORS that I have. Because we're all reading the same statutes. As far as the compensation issue goes, you know, this is just pretty pro forma language. When they cite compensation for OIC non-elected officials, it cross-references back to the general, you know, here's what you get. You know, you can make a whopping $30 a day in expenses. And, you know, I think that, you know, we wanted to be sure we weren't hiring somebody at a six-figure salary. and that won't happen. This is just, you know, usual and customary expenses and some, as I said, $30 a day, I think, is the maximum they can get. And, you know, as long as that's what we're doing, we don't have any problem with that. We do know that these boards take an inordinate amount of time for everybody who gives their time to the boards. And so I think that makes sense. We don't have any problem with the idea that the governor appoints. In fact, we think that makes a lot of sense to do that. In fact, we think it makes more sense to have the governor appoint with Senate confirmation than it does to have the PERS board select from itself. You know, I don't want, our organization does not want this to become a personality contest of who gets along best on the board. We want this to be an appointment that has some public oversight. These folks do invest and are responsible for billions, literally billions of retirement funds. And I think that I've always found the Senate confirmation process to be one of those processes that if there's a problem, anybody can pretty much influence it if there's some legitimate concerns. And so I think it gives you the oversight that you need and allows for the governor to make the initial appointment. So with that, I will turn it over to anybody else who has comments.
For the record, Rich Peppers, I represent the Service Employees International Union Local 503 OPEU. You have my written testimony in front of you. A lot of this has already been covered by previous speakers here. I really don't want to add anything more. I know the value of sitting down when the terrain has been covered, so I think I'll just stop right there.
I'm Beth Ann Darby with the Oregon Education Association, and I will concur with my colleagues and just stress that we also favor governor appointment with following Senate confirmation to the OIC board. We think it's important that qualifications be the primary focus on who sits on OIC, and that gives the governor some leeway in terms of the ability to look at everyone's resume and determine the person that will have the best input and the best background to bring to the OIC. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
illustrious. Thank you very much. Let's see. Then we will move in. Let's see. Steve Manson. Did I pronounce your last name right?
Manson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today regarding House Bill 2117 on changing qualifications for members of the Oregon Investment Council. My name is Steve Manton. I work for the City of Portland and the Office of Finance and Management. I'd like to make three quick points as to why we oppose this bill. First off, the Oregon Investment Council has been a highly effective body in its current configuration. The purpose of the OIC is to invest pension funds and any other funds the state directs in a reasonable and prudent manner, while at the same time striving for high returns on equity. By any standard, OIC has done an excellent job in achieving its goals. Number two, we believe that the current membership structure of the OIC directly contributes to its continued effectiveness. By having members representing both people directly impacted by OIC's actions, as well as members who are not directly impacted by these actions, the OIC is buffered from potentially inappropriate political pressures. Number three, the City of Portland sees no positive benefits to the operation of the OIC by making proposed changes to the Council's membership structure. We would just urge you to vote against this and the amended version of the bill. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Manton? I do have one question, and I just wanted to reiterate, you said right at the end to vote against the bill as well as the proposed amendments, so you think basically this is just, it's not something that's really needed.
Mr. Chair, currently OIC, the three members that the governor has to choose from are the private sector members. At this time, all three members deal in finance. We feel that the other eight members generally don't deal in finance, even though some of the managers may have some financial decisions they make, one of the four managers that are appointed by the governor. So we feel the best opportunity for the board is to get one of the private sector members who quite probably will have a financial background and can speak to those decisions more fully informed than the other members of the PERS board. We know that there are times when there won't be, or potentially won't be, financial members, but we assume that most governors would want to put somebody on both boards that have that background so they could get that experience to OIC as well as the PERS board.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Let's see. Then I would like to have Steve Lanning come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We represent 175,000 working men and women in Oregon. About 35% of them are public employees in the PERS system. I just want to echo what my union colleagues said when they got up here, in that we support the amendment to the bill, and we think that it would provide more flexibility in the appointment to the OIC. And we took a look at some what other states are doing, and it's not like we want to do everything that other states are doing, but most states provide that a member of the retirement system sit on the same body that make the investment decisions. And we think that this amendment would provide the flexibility and leave that up to the governor. And most of the union folks that I talk with feel great about what the OIC is doing right now. They're not questioning that at all. And that's why they wanted to provide the flexibility and offer the amendment that you see in front of you. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Lanning? Representative before.
Thank you. I'm sorry I was watching a little bit late. I guess I'm confused about what problem that we're trying to fix here.
Right now, a PERS member would be prohibited from serving on the OIC, and this would provide flexibility that it would allow a PERS member to be one of the ones that are appointed. just a little bit more flexibility. It isn't necessarily going to change anything, but it has that flexibility added to it.
Yes, go ahead.
So has there been a problem in the past where somebody hasn't, the person who has been chosen to serve on OIC has not accurately reflected the concerns of your organization? Or?
No, there hasn't, but I think among the union community, we're always looking at representation, and with the thousands of members that are PERS members, having a voice on the OIC is something that we've always discussed, and we feel that with the amendment, there's that kind of flexibility that it's possible to have a PERS member, but people aren't talking about a problem.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Lanning? Just out of curiosity, Mr. Lanning, you've heard City of Portland testify that they'd be just as happy if nothing happened. How? And I know I don't expect you to speak for the rest of your union friends, but how would AFL-CIO feel about that?
Mr. Chair, I think we'd like to see the amendment. I think that added flexibility would make us feel more comfortable. And so that's where we're at, and we urge you to accept the amendment.
Okay, thank you. I don't have anyone else signed up for this bill. Is there anyone else that wanted to speak about House Bill 2117? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2117. Members, I think what we'll do is we'll hold off on moving into a work session with this bill. There were some things that we had members that were questioning and would like to get some additional information from the Treasurer. And once we have gotten that information, then I think at that point we could come back and reconsider the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck.
I think the question was asked twice today, and I'm not sure or at least I haven't gotten an answer on the solution chasing a problem. I think, maybe a reasonable little modification, but I think some cases got to be made a little more compellingly that there is change needed, at least as far as I'm concerned, with the other members feel, but I just wanted to get that out in the...
Feel better. Okay. Representative March?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand, especially with the amended version where it gives the opportunity for a PERS member to serve on the board, I can envision perhaps a former treasurer or treasury employee who has great knowledge in the area of finance being on the PERS board and also being very well qualified to serve on the investment council. And so I can see that as with the amendment as a feasible. If we do go with the amendments, we'll need to make one little change on line 24 that would provide except that the member, we'd have to say the except that a member.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are we in work session?
No, we're not.
Sorry.
No, we're not.
I'm just trying to figure out where we're at.
No, actually, I recognize Representative Beck after making a comment that there was some other information wanted on this bill. So, with that, we will move on. Thank you, Representative Hill. I will, open the public hearing on House Bill 2122. And, Matt, why don't you give us a rundown on that, please?
House Bill 2122 requires state agencies to submit bond refunding plans to the state treasurer for approval, provided the treasurer has adopted rules relating to the type of plan being considered, authorizes refunding to proceed if the treasurer fails to approve within 30 days, and declares an emergency, making the bill effective on passage.
Thank you. And Treasurer Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer, Oregon. House Bill 2122 is a simple housekeeping bill, and with me is Chuck Smith from the Debt Management Division, who can walk you through maybe more the technical side of this bill. It deals with two types of refunding bonds, advance refunding and forward current refunding. Generally speaking, refunding is analogous to refinancing a mortgage. It is selling bonds at a lower interest rate to pay off bonds to that were issued at a higher interest rate. Forward current refundings are short-term refundings, typically 1 year or less, and advanced refundings are long-term refundings. This bill clarifies when a refunding plan must be submitted to the state treasurer for review and approval and when one does not. It specifies that a plan to issue advance refunding bonds must be submitted to the treasurer for review and approval. However, a plan to issue forward current refunding bonds must be submitted to the treasurer for review and approval only if the treasurer has adopted rules for this type of refunding. If the treasurer has not, and that's me, I keep talking about the treasurer, if I have not adopted such rules, the plan does not need to be submitted to the to me for review and approval. The reason for this is that it is not necessary to adopt rules and review and approve forward current refunding because of their short time nature. The bill also clarifies that after reviewing a proposed refunding plan, it is my responsibility who must notify a public body within 30 days of whether the sale of refunding bonds is authorized. It is the treasurer, myself. If we fail to make such a notification within 30 days, this is deemed an authorization to proceed. Again, a lot of technical language about what we're trying to do. It's just how we manage these two types of financing techniques and clarifying in law how we address refundings. And Chuck Smith could add to that if you have any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
We have a -1 amendment.
Yes. And
yes, we do have one amendment.
You texted me, I think, to say a little bit about who's offering those amendments and the purpose of them.
Well, I think for the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm the debt manager at the Oregon State Treasury. With respect to the -1 amendments, I think Mr. Armstrong's in the back of the room and who's proposing these amendments. The Treasury thinks that these amendments or the -1 amendments are very worthwhile and important to a particular segment of school bonds in especially, and that's really what the -1 amendment is directed at. The state currently operates the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act, which has been an extraordinarily successful program. It just started essentially 2 years ago, and essentially the act, which the treasurer proposed to the legislature, allows the state to give its full faith and credit guarantee to local school bonds, and by doing so, the local school bonds can be rated the same as the state's rating, AA. In other words, you could have a low-rated school bond or a non-rated school bond achieve a AA rating in the marketplace by qualifying and participating in the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act. This AA rating reduces the amount of interest they pay in their bonds, reduces the amount of taxes directly collected to pay for those bonds. It's been a very successful program. The state we're looking at probably having about $800 million in bonds guaranteed by the end of this month. One technical problem comes up with school bonds. Many school bonds have a maturity or payment date on December 1st. They've done this to coincide that payment date with the arrival of funds, tax collections, to pay the bonds. The Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act, as one of the credit features of the act, requires school districts to make payments to a paying agent 15 days prior to the payment date. In other words, in this case, let's say their payment date's December 1st, they had to pay by November 15th, they've got to submit all the money to pay the bonds. And this is a credit enhancement, makes the program sound, and it's worthwhile, would give the Treasury any alert that a school district might not be able to make their payment in a timely fashion. So what we have here is we're asking that we allow the refunding bonds to be extended to 30 days to cover that period in December so that school districts that have maturity dates of December 1st can participate in the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act and thus reduce their costs. This is a simple housekeeping measure. We're only asking for a 30-day extension so that people can participate. And that's what the amendment's all about.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to that School Bond Guarantee Act, that was a bill passed in 1997, which is really saving local school districts millions of dollars in interest payments. I think the section that we looked at, about $69 million in interest costs, because now school districts can borrow at a cheaper rate than what they might have if they'd gone to the open market without this guarantee or being able to interface with the state's better credit. So, you know, we had this discussion in this committee before, by the way, about a security fund or stabilization fund. I talked basically state finances. If somehow we had a downgrade in our credit rating, you would also now see the potential for this that affecting school districts and their ability to borrow at a cheaper rate. So, again, bringing something else up, but again, this program has been extremely successful, and we're going to be pretty soon telling the school districts that it's going to be opened up even farther as far as being able to use the program. We were concerned that we were at some capacity, but it looks like we're going to be able to open that up and let them guarantee more bonds. So it's a very successful program.
Any questions, Representative Cruz?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, I remember very well doing that, and it was a good piece of work. And we've had a lot of school districts going out for levies and having them approved in the last couple of years. Is there a sense of what percent of those have applied for this? I mean, is this almost a standard thing they're doing now, or?
I think nearly every school district has run through this program now.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Ken Armstrong. Come up, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ken Armstrong. I'm here this morning representing Seattle Northwest Securities, the proposer of the amendments that Mr. Smith just very ably described. He essentially gave my testimony, so I'm not going to repeat everything that he just said. He correctly characterized it as a housekeeping issue. I would like to make a real clear point that what we're talking about is a change that is going to enable the school districts to do the advance refunding bonds and save the taxpayers money, something that we would, because of a glitch in the current statute, would not be able to do under the school guarantee program. So it's a straightforward sort of thing. Just simply deals with the date and when debt service payments need to be made and expanding that. And I'm not going to go any further into repeating what Chuck just said. So be happy to answer any questions. We think it's a good fix. The reason we're proposing it as part of this bill is we have an LC draft currently in the pipeline on this issue, and because this ended up being the same subject, we thought it made a lot more sense just to piggyback with this, save you the trouble of dealing with two bills when you can just deal with one. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Armstrong? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. I don't have anyone else on the list to testify on House Bill 2122. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Seeing none, close public hearing on House Bill 2122. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2122. Would certainly entertain a motion to adopt the -1 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Before we go there, yeah. On line 22 of the -1 amendments, I've just never seen it the way they've written it this way. Because there's a second 2 in the line,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if the amendments are crafted properly. Normally, if there's a second word, it's the same, they'll say the first word or after, because there's two numeral twos. One could read the amendment to change both numeral twos to 3, which wouldn't make sense. It's just a technical issue, and we might check with LC to see if it would be read that way or not.
I'm not sure I understand what you're talking about.
It was on the -1 amendments.
Yes.
It's amending line 29 of the bill.
Yes.
It's just to change section 2 to section 3.
Yes.
But since in the same line in the numeral 2001 there is a second numeral 2, the way this is written, normally when you see that, they'll say the first 2 replaced with the 3, as to oppose it to replacing the numeral 2. So I think it's just a technical issue that we may check with legislative council to make sure that it doesn't become a 3001 act.
Right.
So it's a just it's a small technical thing. I don't think it's big, but it could be. You know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Cruz. Well, the reality is, and I think Representative Hill's right. This is a technical oversight. I think we can do the amendment with that note to make sure that LC clarifies it. And thank you for pointing that out. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash one amendment.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cruz moves the dash one amendments. And may I assume, Representative, with the understanding that the two replaces the two after section.
Mr. Chair, all we have to do is make a note to LC to make sure that they crafted it right. And if there is a discrepancy, they'll clean it up. So it's not a substantive change.
Okay. Is there any discussion about the dash one amendments? Seeing none, is there any objection to the dash one amendments? Seeing none, dash one amendments are adopted. I would entertain a motion to...
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I will move House Bill 2122 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz has moved House Bill 2122 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I would move that House Bill 2122 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Cruz moves that House Bill 2122 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. This will be placed on the consent calendar. Great. Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2122. And now we will go into a work session on House Bill 2119. We have some, I believe, some dash one amendments on this, don't we?
Somebody should have them in your hand. Turn it on. 2121.
Oh, excuse me. Let me close the work session on 2119 and move that back to work session on House Bill 2121. Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, let's go. We should have some dash one amendments for House Bill 2121. These are the some of the things that Representative Hill had talked about on Tuesday with regards to this bill. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2121.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2121. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the dash one amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
I move House Bill 2121 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hill moves House Bill 2121 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2121 as amended is moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Toomey.
I move that House Bill 2121 be on the consent agenda.
Representative Toomey moves House Bill 2121 be on the consent calendar of the House. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2121 will be on the consent calendar of the House. Thank you. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2121, and I will open. Now we can go back to 2119. Yeah. Is there something? Wait.
Let me open a, go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2119. I'm trying to remember, committee, if this was a bill that we had, that we wanted to have any amendments on, and I don't have anything in my notes that says that we do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hill.
I think we were looking for some clarification of why they were exempting the entire public contracting in the public contracting laws. In addition, I have a question, and I'm not quite comfortable with how they've constructed how the policies are crafted on the back on the page 3.
Okay.
But other than that, I don't object to the substantive change.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Edwards, would you like to come back up and
thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and with me is Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's Office, who is the counsel to the Oregon Growth Account. So maybe she could speak specifically the language that Representative Hill questioned and cover that.
That would be good if we can have some clarification. Thank
sure.
You.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I think what you were talking about...
speak your name for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's Office.
Thank you.
I think you had questions on the language just above Section 3 about the change in the public contracting laws to Chapter 279. The purpose of that change, under the original statutes, this board was exempt from the public contracting requirements with respect to their management contracts and some things like that. And the reason for that, there are a couple of reasons. One, there are some old opinions out there that talk about the respective roles of a constitutional officer like the Treasury and the ability of an agency like the Department of Administrative Services to oversee how it performs some of its functions. And for that reason, the state treasurer is actually exempt from a lot of the public contracting laws already. But it's helpful to sort of clarify that in these types of individual statutes. Then there are also some provisions in Chapter 279 that deal with wage and hour requirements and things like that that... when you read the entire set of statutes, they require people who contract with the state to follow recycling laws, to post certain minimum wage and hour requirements and things like that. When you read them in context, it looks like they were intended to address public improvements contracts, but the language of the statute in the introduction talks about every contract with the state. So part of this amendment is intended to clarify that those types of requirements really don't belong in this type of contract. And there actually is another bill in that's going to clean up those statutes, but just in case, cleans it up here, too.
Mr. Chair, what I'm reading is that the state treasurer does not believe in recycling.
Mr. Chair, that's, Representative Hill, that's current statute that you've got there that's exempting us from that. So you made that decision some years ago.
I believe that under the prudent investor rule, you have to earn money before you care about recycling. So.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
we got the construction on page 3 of the bill, lines 4 through 13 in terms of view. Sort of, I'm assuming, did you draft this?
Yeah, I'm guilty.
I'm trying to understand in terms of where, in the present law, in terms of the state treasurer can establish whatever policies he wants, and we've sort of put some, well, they're not really sideboards, because they're just things that may, but the one here, this determination of when and how earnings are calculated and declared available, is that a policy? I mean,
in a sense, it is. That's in response to some issues and some questions that have arisen. There are a number of different statutes that talk about the Education Endowment Fund, and I think you're aware that the Oregon Growth Account is an account that's established within the Education endowment fund, which is created under the Constitution. Under the Constitution, the account can retain earnings if it wants to and essentially grow the pot to get more earnings over time. A related statute in Chapter 348, 348.702 also gives the treasurer or the account the authority to retain earnings to grow the pot. But there are other statutes that talk about, for instance, the Oregon Education Fund statute that says earnings from the Education Endowment Fund are used for this purpose, or earnings from the Oregon Growth Account are used for this purpose. And it's been unclear as to who was supposed to be deciding what the earnings were and when they were available. And there are actually potentially going to be three different accounts in the Education Endowment Fund if all the legislation that's in this session passes. So we're hoping to clarify that it's the board that's responsible for the individual account and managing it that decides, you know, where in this flow of investments you actually have earnings that are available to be distributed outside the account. For instance, you could decide every time a cash distribution is made, that's earnings, or you could decide, well, I'm going to wait until the end of the whole 10-year life of this investment to make sure that I've gotten back everything I put in, and then I'm going to decide that they're earnings. So this gives that decision, it clarifies that decision-making authority is with the treasurer who has the policy-making authority for this board.
Thank you.
Yes.
Submit House Bill 2119 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Same. President Hill moves House Bill 2119 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Mark.
Actually, I had one more question.
Okay, that's fine.
And I had asked this last time, and perhaps your experience with the Attorney General's office could clarify. A venture capital firm in Oregon investing in Oregon companies may realize capital gains in Oregon and therefore would be taxable on those capital gains and would pay into the tax system here. A venture firm in, say, Washington State realizing capital gains on investments in Oregon would not be eligible for those same capital gains taxes, as I understand it. Is that correct?
You're talking about the general partner in the partnership?
Right.
If it's in Oregon, I'm not a tax attorney.
Right.
So even though I'm in the tax and finance section, I represent the treasurer's office.
Okay.
I'm not a tax attorney. I'm the finance staff. If you have an Oregon company that's subject to Oregon tax and it has capital gains, then it would pay in accordance with Oregon law. If you have a Washington company, they will pay in accordance with Washington law. There are some provisions, and I'm not an expert in them, in terms of when some of your income is earned in Oregon, how much is attributable to Oregon and how much is attributable to Washington. That's the extent of my knowledge with respect to those things.
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative March, and I think you got to step back a little bit. The whole intent of this is to do two things, well, three things really. One is that, again, generate money for the Education Endowment Fund. We, as was described by Mr. Craven with the AEA, part of the intent was to use some of this money to get money to the within that fund, to use some of the money to get returns for the Education Endowment Fund, also to help seed venture capital in Oregon, and also to help, as I believe Representative March is getting at, is to try to get companies to start up here to be general partners. And some of the companies we spoke about, some are started because of the fact that we were able to help seed them and then they were able to attract capital. So the whole game here is to balance leveraging money to startup companies who in the end will pay taxes in Oregon because, the mandate's Oregon investments, and to try to encourage more money to be leveraged here in the state to help create these partnerships, as is the case, I believe Tamarack is an Oregon-based company, for example. So the idea is to try to grow that as well, and I'm mindful of not trying to grow general partners outside of the state, but I'm also interested in trying to get those general partners to give us a little more window to put more money to work here in Oregon so that we can create more companies here in the state, and then that in turn will generate more jobs and income for Oregon.
as long as we keep the idea that we also want to not only invest in firms in Oregon, but also maybe encourage the venture capital firms to establish here and like maintain some sort of balance in that.
Just to give an example, because I remember Representative Hill was interested in kind of the leveraging Smart Forest Ventures, which is again an Oregon-based company. The Oregon Growth Account gave $6 million, and they went out and helped raise $25 million off of that. So, and then in turn, they also were able to get a SBIC loan, which is a government loan, which also leveraged additional money. So the whole idea is it's like an inverse pyramid scheme in a sense, in that you're leveraging yourself to get more money. Again, those investments are going to be driven here in Oregon. So the whole game is to try to get to use this money to leverage more money, to put money into the hands of startup companies in Oregon. That's the intent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, is there any other discussion? Seeing none, let's see. The motion is from Representative Hill to move House Bill 2119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Members, I think that this is a bill that probably ought to have some discussion on the floor as opposed to going into the consent calendar. And what I wonder is, Representative March, would you be willing to carry it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2119. Sure. And we don't have anything else before us today, so I will close the committee. We are adjourned.